You're going to love my next guest. Pat Welsh stopped by the show. He is an author, speaker, and trainer with over 30 years of law enforcement experience on the front lines of some of the most violent streets of America. He has been trained by the best, including the FBI and Secret Service. He has been recognized during his outstanding police career by such agencies such as the FBI, Secret Service, Dayton Police Department, and the National Police Athletic League. He has been on the protection details of three presidents and other dignitaries. He is a member of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and he has trained thousands of cops, civilians, and military police on the warrior, servant, leader mindset through his company, P.J. Welsh & Associates, LLC. You do not want to miss this great and informative show with Pat Welsh, next on the Criminal Justice Evolution Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here. Thank you for tuning in. We know you got many options, but you keep coming back to the CJ Evolution Podcast. That's why we're top ranked. Top ranked because of you, the listener and supporter. Thank you so much. If you haven't already, please take a moment and give us that five-star rating and review on Apple Podcast. We sure would appreciate it. And a big shout out to all the first responders out there, brave men and women, all of you, serving and protecting your communities and this great country. Without you, I firmly believe we would not have this great country we have. Along with the military, we can't forget the military. Remember this, you are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Keep up the fantastic work. You know, it's such an honor to be partnered with an amazing and innovative company like Detecticam. Now, if you've never heard of this company, you really need to check them out. You can see their link on cjevolution.com. And Detecticam is helping keep our brave first responders and military personnel safer by offering mobile threat detection fits in the palm of their hands, detecting illicit drugs, explosives, now COVID-19. This application-based technology is a must-have for your organization. Head over to cjevolution.com, see the link to Detecticam, and see how they can help keep your personnel safer. Are you in charge of your organization's extra duty program, along with all the other assignments and projects that you have on your plate? I know how overwhelming it can be. Let me tell you about my good friends at Extra Duty Solutions. They help law enforcement agencies add efficiency and effectiveness to their extra duty programs while allowing them to focus on what really matters, and that's the safety of their citizens. They work with law enforcement agencies everywhere to help administer their extra duty programs. They can assist with client interactions, scheduling, invoicing, collections, officer payments, feedback, problem resolution, cash flow management, and much more. Their services are provided at no cost to the department and a minimal cost to the clients, and programs can be customized to meet the goals and unique needs of any agency. Folks, you need Extra Duty Solutions. Head over to ExtraDutySolutions.com. That's ExtraDutySolutions.com, and tell them Patrick from the CJ Evolution Podcast sent you. On to the show with Pat Welsh. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my friend Pat Welsh on the show. I actually met Pat. We met, about a year ago in Fort Collins through a mutual friend, and I'm glad he's on the show. He's all over LinkedIn. Pat's all over LinkedIn, and he's going to tell us about his great background, his very honorable career in law enforcement, and other things he's doing. Pat, welcome, brother. Glad you're here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, you have a distinguished career in law enforcement, but I want you to tell people, for people who don't know who Pat is, who's Pat Welsh?
Distinguished. That's a nice way of putting it. I have a very unique way. I did everything but backwards, if you will. I got my degree in criminal justice back in 1979. I went straight to law school and got out of law school, started immediately, even before I was admitted to the bar, waiting on my bar results. I was hired as a city prosecutor in a small jurisdiction outside of Dayton, Ohio, and then fortunately passed the bar exam and started my career as a prosecutor traffic and misdemeanor. Then I became a special prosecutor. I was kind of a hired gun on cases that had conflicts of interest. And then I became an assistant county prosecutor, or assistant DA, and was doing the felony stuff for several years. And I was about 28 years old, been married about 6 years, had two children, hated what I was doing. And my wife finally said to me one evening, it's like, Pat, you're never happy. What is it you want to be doing? I said, well, actually, I want to be a cop and have been ever since I was 9, 10 years old. And she's like, well, go do it. And so she goes, are you sure this is really what you want to do? And I go, well, I'll tell you what, you know, I'm playing on a police softball team. And the chief of a small township agency is willing to bring me on board as like a, you know, dollar a year, an auxiliary cop.
Yeah.
And why don't I do that? And I had to get the permission of the elected DA, which he gave. He just told me, don't handle any cases that you're involved in as a police officer. And so for about 10 months, I worked an 8-hour shift once a week, midnight shift once a week for $10 a shift. And wow. I liked it and it liked me. And so I took the Dayton, Ohio Police Department test and got on board. And 1986 to 2012, I put in a 26-year career and retired as a major of operations patrol in 2012 and moved to Colorado.
Wow.
So I took a kind of an odd way of getting there, but I kept practicing law. I kept my license and I was doing, you know, civil stuff, not criminal. And for the last almost 9 years now, I'm an adjunct instructor for the Southern Police Institute out of the University of Louisville, and combining my legal background and my law enforcement background, and I train cops all over the country now in a variety of law enforcement topics. So, as you say, living the dream.
Well, thank you for your service, brother. I mean, just amazing background. And the question I have, and you probably got this, I mean, I think it would be just amazing to have somebody like you who's a lawyer on board in a police department. You have your in-house, you know, not that you're, you know, doing the lawyer aspect, but I'm sure you got questions all the time. Hey, Pat, I'm kind of confused with this case, or can you interpret this statute for me? You can interpret this law for me. Did you get a lot of that in your career? I imagine you did.
And I had actually several assignments that were very directly related to the having that legal background. When I was commander of narcotics on our department, every application for a search warrant had to be reviewed by your sergeant and then reviewed by your commander. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to we did 300 search warrants in 3 years.
Wow.
When I was commander over there. So every one of those, I was able to look at and review with that legal mindset.
Sure.
And occasionally you had to tweak things or,
yeah.
And then when we executed the warrants, I had to be on, unless it was just a paper warrant, like, you know, a bank, we did a lot of, you know, high risk and semi high risk drug warrants, and they had to be supervised by a commander. So I was on those, and we actually had a case once where I was at the back of the stack as we were making the approach, and I realized, hey, we passed the house that you showed in the briefing as being the house we were hitting. So I tapped and stopped, and we withdrew. And what turned out is we were going to the right house, the picture that the detective showed in the briefing. Mm-hmm. They had taken a picture of the house next door by mistake.
Oh.
So, you know, with that legal kind of perception, plus the training mindset, of law enforcement. And then I went in and then took command of violent crimes and homicide and all sorts of other, you know, units. Sure. So the legal background was very helpful. And then through all of that, I was also a contract negotiator because we were, you know, a contract state. So I got to represent officers and sergeants and lieutenants in the negotiation aspect. And that's all legal kind of stuff. So it served my career very well. I'm glad I had that background. I just didn't like practicing the day-to-day grind of being a prosecutor.
Yeah. Well, and it must have been interesting because I imagine early on in your career and probably during your career at different points, you were on the stand, right? You were probably getting cross-examined by some defense attorney and you're like, hey, man, I know all the tricks. You can't pull that BS on me.
Yep, you know? Absolutely.
So
it worked. It really worked out well. I did 6 years while I was a cop. I was an expert witness in federal court. on law enforcement issues. So that whole package made me a more well-rounded police officer, and it also made me a more well-rounded lawyer when I needed to express and articulate positions. I could articulate how cops think and felt and why they did what they did because I'd been there and done that.
Sure.
So it had a really great impact.
Yeah. Now, did you come from a family, brother, of law enforcement? Is law enforcement in your blood, the law in your blood? Or
Nope.
Okay.
Well, actually, first of all, I'm adopted. So I was born in Ireland. So, an Irish Catholic cop lawyer, genetically, it's probably there. The only thing I wasn't was, a Catholic priest. But I did have an uncle on my mom's side of the family. By marriage, he was an uncle that was a Cincinnati police officer.
Okay.
Back in the, 50s and whatnot. So that was my only exposure to law enforcement in real life, was seeing that uncle, twice a year.
Yeah.
On family visits.
Yeah. So let's pivot a little bit, brother. I mean, you talk to cops everywhere. You train cops everywhere. They're probably a lot more virtually now. You see all the stuff in the media about cops and, a lot of anti-police sentiment, even though I believe that the majority of people out there do support law enforcement. Where do you think law enforcement is heading? There's an attack on qualified immunity. There's all kinds of attacks on law enforcement from everything they want to. You got, a president now, advocating when he was running to shoot somebody in the leg to stop a threat. I mean, where do you think we're going with all this stuff? I mean, it's a scary time. I mean, I still have hope and I believe in law enforcement. And I think we're very resilient. But what's your take on all this?
My answer, I guess, would be multi-pronged. Yeah. From the officer standpoint, you have to maintain that warrior, servant, leader That's mindset. Right. You are there to protect and serve. You are there to impact and influence your community, your agency. So take the high road. I know how easy it is to give it the old mindset. Mm-hmm. We can't let that overpower us. You can maybe privately over beers and chicken wings after a shift. We can bitch about stuff, but when you put that uniform on, you have to have that genuine, I am here to protect and serve. So keep that high road attitude. Mm-hmm. From the other prong, the community side of it, is we need to do a better job of educating the community and involving the community in who we are and what we do and why we do certain things. I was just reading an article today on data-driven policing and community relations, and they failed to realize the academics, the community, and whatnot. If you are policing a 90% African-American population and you happen to be white, those are your population and your ethnicity. You can't change that. Mm-hmm. And no data in the world is going to change that. So what we have to do is develop the relationships and the conversations of getting beyond data. More blacks are arrested for X, Y, or Z. 90% of the area that I'm patrolling is black.
Yeah. So
it's going to, statistically, right. In common sense, it's going to look like, hey, I'm a white guy and I'm only arresting blacks mm-hmm. or Latinos or whatever it is. So we need to get more involved with the community and get the community more involved with us. Now, just very briefly, by example, in Dayton, back in 08, we chief initiated it's called CIRV, Community Initiative to Reduce Gun Violence. And 48% of our homicides were gang related somehow. And 90% of our homicides were African-American suspects. And we were running 70, 80 homicides a year. And the chief goes, we need to impact that. And we could not police our way out of gang-related murders. So we developed a three-prong initiative that involved the community, actively involved the criminal justice system, the judges, the probation, parole, all that kind of stuff, and involved the police. And the community got, and we all ended up wanting the same message being delivered, is stop the killing. And the police part of it was like maybe 15 or 20% of actually active, you know, enforcement. And the rest of it was community driven and law and criminal justice system driven. We reduced gang murders by 64% in 2 years and kept it, kept it there. And it wasn't about race. It was about the criminal element and the community finally having the confidence to stand up, so that Black pastors, Black civic leaders, Black neighbors were saying, we're tired of this in our backyard, in our community. And they had the support of the police to go, we're going to do something about it. And so that whole, you know this, you know, I was there, but I didn't see nothing. You know, it's the code of silence in the community. Sure. Don't be a rat. Don't be a snitch, whatever. By involving the community and having those conversations and being very open and transparent about what we can do and can't do, how we're going to do it, how do you want us to do it, what are your expectations, and having the judges and probation and parole on board with us with the same message, there's going to be consequences, we accomplished our mission. And that was in 2008, and they're still operating that way in Dayton, Ohio. It wasn't a one shot. Oh, we arrived, and now we can stop doing what we're doing. We institutionalized it, and they still are keeping the numbers down, and they're keeping the community involved in participating in the accountability for the neighborhoods, for the criminal element, and for the police. We're being held accountable to, we said we're going to do this, now the community is going to do it. So I think, you know, from where we're at today with the whole defund the police and equity and equality and all this banter that you're hearing, it's coming from people that don't understand what's really going on in communities and what communities really want and need and the police want to do. That doesn't need the politicians intervening. You know, Sun Tzu in The Art of War has said, the greatest chance of success for change, police reform, if you will, is not from the external imposition of rules and regulations, but the internalization that the change has value. And so I think that's where the conversation should be had. With the police, with the community, we don't need new rules and regulations. We need to understand what the change is, the value of that change, and we internalize it and call it buy-in or whatever you want. And we have a much greater chance of success. And I know that works. It worked for us on the gang violence. There were no new laws, no new budget, no new assignment. There wasn't a task force created in moving manpower. Nothing new was created other than communication, accountability, and a shared vision and goal and value of the courts, the police, and the community. And it worked. That's what we need.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100%. Education is key, and having that partnership, that good partnership with the community. I agree. But from my perspective, brother, I don't think I've ever seen a time where, I mean, it used to be years ago where, you know, police have always been under the microscope. You know that. And we should be under the microscope, you know, because of the power and you know, we possess, and we can make an arrest, use force, all that stuff. Everybody knows that. But I remember a day not too long ago, or it seemed like not too long ago, where politicians by and large would back up the police. They would support the police. They might not agree with them, but they would support him. I think what we're seeing now, and in fact, I know we're seeing now, you can see it, not with every politician, but I think some of the problem, a big problem is, you mentioned keeping politics out of it. Well, politics are immersed in now law enforcement. And I think that just compounds the problem with making it more and more difficult for law enforcement to do job. I'm not saying it's not impossible. I agree with everything you said. But don't you think that because of the political, very political environment that we now live in, it's much more harder when you have now popular politicians on both sides sometimes saying, look, we need to, I don't agree with the police are doing, we need to abolish them and all this other stuff. It just makes it more difficult, right?
It makes it more difficult, but not impossible.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go back to, it was so easy for cops to, and I headed up the initiative in Dayton, mostly because I kind of opened my mouth in a staff meeting and the chief goes, see me after staff.
Volunteered.
And yeah, I was voluntold. And, you know, the initial attitude within law enforcement was, and this wasn't just a Dayton, it originated with the Dayton Police Department, but it became regional. The FBI joined us, the DEA joined us, ATF joined us, adult parole, probation. There was all these partners in it. But the initial reaction was two things. This sounds like hug a thug. I'm not going to go out there and babysit and put my arm around gangsters, telling them, please quit killing one another. And they did. They called it hug a thug. And the other thing was, from the police standpoint, was, hey, what's the big deal? It's dopers killing dopers. You know, isn't that good for us? Mm-hmm. Kind of that kind of mindset. And I get what you're saying, but let me put it into kind of this linear progression. How you think drives your attitude.
Absolutely.
Because attitude is a settled way of thinking. So everything begins with how you think. Mm-hmm. If you think you can't do it, then your attitude is going to be settled way of thinking is, well, I can't do it.
Love it. Yeah.
Or if you go, I can do this, then you're going to develop an attitude that reinforces what you think. So if you, in the talk of defunding the police and how hard it is and politicians and these different groups and whatnot, if you think you can't overcome that, then that's what's going to happen. Yeah. But if you follow this progression, how you think determines your attitude. Your attitude, settled way of thinking, become actions. So if you have kids and you say to your teenage son, I don't like the way I don't like your attitude. What I'm really saying is, I don't like the way you're behaving because I can't read your mind. Mm-hmm. But your attitudes are displayed in behaviors. And repeated behaviors become habits. Yep. And then habits, the accepted and expected way of thinking and attitude and behaving, those habits become your culture. And so if we want to do police reform in all these areas, and people, their idea of reform is defunding, that isn't reforming anything. You're eliminating. That's not reformation. That's you are eliminating people and jobs and response time and all that kind of stuff. If we want police reform, then we need to change the culture of law enforcement. But we also need to change the culture of the community. You know, that code of silence in the community. Mm-hmm. It's still an open case. I was the watch commander. There was a homicide at a biker bar, an African-American biker bar. 200, I'm not exaggerating, 200 eyewitnesses. I responded. 200 eyewitnesses were still there. They didn't take off.
Nobody saw anything.
It's a cold case. I don't know nothing about nothing. That's culture. Mm-hmm. That is the expected and acceptable way of thinking, talking, and acting between the community and the police. We can't change that. The community needs to change that. Mm-hmm. So I think in answer to your question of what we are finding ourselves in now is we have to define what is the culture that we're trying to change, both in the police department, in law enforcement, but what's the culture in the community? The culture is what is expected and accepted way of dealing with the police is to cancel them, defund them, disband them, whatever you want to call it. Well, that's what we need to change is, well, what's driving that? What is their thinking and their attitude and their behaviors, repeated behaviors that has created that culture? How do we change how they think? That's where we have to start. Yeah. Why do they think we're the enemy? Why do they think all cops are racist? Why do they think, fill in the blank, and then we have to change how they think. And you've seen it in stories where there's been someone who's been very critical of officer-involved shootings, and why didn't they do this X, Y, or Z? And the police invite that person into, hey, take our shoot, don't shoot training. And what's it do? It changes how they think. And they come around, not all shootings are going to be good, but they now come around to an understanding. I didn't realize it was that quick on a traffic stop. I didn't think the police, and then fill in the blank. I didn't think it would turn deadly. I didn't think they would shoot me. Whatever it is, change how you think, change attitudes, change behaviors.
Yeah, I love
that's
that.
My message.
No, I love it. I mean, thoughts become things, and I love what you said about that. I mean, it's law. I mean, I believe in law of attraction. So what you put out there, you're going to get back. If cops constantly think, well, life sucks and everything sucks and community hates me, I guess you're going to get that right in return. Yeah. So we have to change the way we think. Not that, I mean, there has to come, you know, back it up with action too. But that's great, brother. I agree with everything you said. Now let's switch. Go ahead, sir.
But just let me real quick. What goes along with that? Is to put it in a very practical perception. Whatever you're looking for, you will always find more of it. if you're looking for the worst in somebody, you will find more of the worst. And so what we need to do is, as cops, we know when we're dealing with a situation that's going to go south, or, you know, we're a good judge of people's nonverbal communication. But if we're looking for the worst in our politicians, we're looking for the worst in our community leaders, we're looking for the worst in fill in the blank, we will always find more of it. But the flip side of that is true for the community. If the people who are advocating defund the police, or a very critical, destructive reformation of law enforcement in America, if that's what they're looking for, that's all they're going to find. And so part of our responsibility is to educate the community. You know what? Nobody talks about police athletic leagues anymore. Mm-hmm. They still exist. What great work cops are doing off duty on their own time in working with at-risk kids in the community. So we need to show the community things that make us a value to the community, not just enforcers, because you know it. Actual law enforcement, being a cop, is actually about that much of enforcement and about 90% of being that father, that mentor, that sounding board, whatever it is. That we're doing more social work, if you want to call it that, than we are doing enforcement. It's going to take time, but you know what? In 2 years, we brought down gang violence, homicides by 64%. It's doable.
Yeah, and I believe, as you do, brother. I mean, law enforcement is resilient. I mean, there's peaks and valleys in the profession, and there's low times and high times. And I remember, you know, Rodney King, you know, and all, you know, and you knew too. I mean, you know, other high profile incidents of the past, you know, where law enforcement was. You know, there's a dark cloud over law enforcement, but we overcame, we adjusted.
But we also dealt with it.
Yeah, we dealt with it.
You know, there was punishment that came out of that. And the system, the justice system, worked.
Yeah.
And because it worked, that's our best evidence that disbanding law enforcement is not the proper response. It's kind of like having kids. If your one kid is a bad apple, and they just keep repeatedly getting in trouble and doing, you know, whatever, using drugs and shoplifting and what that. You don't punish your other kids because of you have one bad apple in your household. You deal with the child that is causing the problems. Mm-hmm. And that's true in corporate world, and it's true in the, you know, public sector.
And I agree with you. And I think that's one of the misnomers that not everybody in the public has, but definitely some. I teach a lot. I know you talk to a lot of people, and I know some of my students, they still think we're living in the area of like Serpico, where everybody's like, all the cops are corrupt. They're on the take. They're out there beating people every day, shooting everybody. And I'm like, I always tell them, are there corrupt cops and bad cops? Absolutely. Just like there's bad drivers and bad pilots and bad everything else. But the overwhelming majority of the brave men and women are good people just doing a very difficult job in a very difficult environment. But the point is that perception out there permeates with some people, a certain segment of society. And I agree with you. It's nothing we can't get over and teach and educate, but it's like, where are they coming from? I mean, where are you getting this stuff? I mean, no cop gets up in the morning and says, you know what? Kisses their wife goodbye, leaves their house they work hard for, gets in the car and says, you know what? I'm going to go shoot somebody.
And if there is that cop out there, they're psychotic.
Oh, exactly.
It's not the uniform that creates that. It's they're up here. And that's kind of one of the things that I think law enforcement needs to spend more time on is developing those early warning systems, because every police, it happened to you, it happened to me, it happens to every single cop. We go through a progression and there's cycles. Great book on it, written 1999 by Joan Barker. Danger, Duty, and Disillusion, A Worldview of the LAPD. And she got her master's degree. It was actually a research project, but she identified five stages of a law enforcement career. And one of those stages is disillusionment, where your idealism of why you became a cop collides with the reality of policing and why does the community hate us? And there's this friction, and it causes stress, and you get disillusioned. You know, why'd I ever do this? You know, and you start seeing, that's when the divorces start seeing behavioral things going on in an officer's life. And we don't typically have an early warning system in place that can help us get that officer through that disillusionment stage. Maybe they got a citizen complaint, maybe they got disciplined and their morale tanks, whatever it is. Things at home suck. They're going through bank. Something's going on in their life that's causing the stress that's manifested in behavior. And maybe you start seeing a cop that never got a citizen complaint for being rude, and he's gotten five this month.
That's a red flag.
That's a flag telling you, but we don't have a system in place typically to work that officer through that disillusionment and get them back to that idealism of protecting and serving. They become, you see it, guys retire on duty. You know, hey, F this, I'm going to just collect my paycheck and ride out, you know, till I can retire. That there's something going on in that cop's life that needs to be addressed. And we don't have, that's the kind of reform that would impact our community relations, is we get those early warning signs. We get the mentoring. We don't attach a stigma to a cop who goes, hey, I need to go see, the department psychologist or whatever. I'm struggling with fill in the blank, PTSD. I'm having trouble at home. I'm drinking too much now. And I recognize, and you do that, or you ask for light duty or restricted duty to help you get through some, not physical that we can see injury, but that you're suffering somehow. We stigmatize that cop and we exercise,
ostracize. We push him,
ostracize, that's the word. So cops keep it inside and they don't share because they don't want to be seen as. And that's police reform, that if we engaged in that and we're serious and genuine about being a family, a brotherhood of and sisterhood of law enforcers and protectors and servants, then that would transfer itself into positive police community relations.
And I think part of good leadership, brother, is I remember when I was a supervisor, if I noticed some behavioral change in one of my officers, I would go to the officer and say, hey, what's going on? You know, then there were other supervisors who would notice behavioral changes, talk about it amongst the other sergeants or the other supervisors, but never actually go to the officer with the behavioral issues or change or whatever, or now who once talkative, very silent. So something is going on. So I agree with you. I think part of it's leadership issue where, I mean, we could talk leadership all day, but I think, you know, I agree everything, you know, these early warning systems. And I think there are departments that have that, but I think it comes down to just having a conversation with somebody and saying, okay, I noticed, man, I've known you for 5 years, Pat, something's going on. You've been quiet. Your performance is going down. You're usually a go-getter. What's going on in your life? I don't think a lot of leaders or some leaders do that.
I don't think they do either. But I won't throw that expectation out on supervisors. And you don't have to be a supervisor to be a leader.
No.
But is that, you know, look at how many agencies finally saw the value of specifically training street cops crisis intervention. And because we can't just tell a street cop or any cop, go, hey, be a little bit more empathetic, or, you know, if you're on a call and you see something X, Y, or Z, you know, try and get to the bottom of it without giving them training on how to solve the problem. You know, crisis intervention, yes, and we're doing it a lot now with de-escalation. But you can have all those skills, but if you don't solve the problem, you're going to keep going back to that address on those calls. Mm-hmm. And the same way with talking to your troops is, hey, you know, Patrick, you seem a little quiet and down and out. And Patrick lays his heart out to you and you go, oh, man, what do I do now?
Yeah.
I've opened up that can of worms and I don't have the skill set. What do I do next? Well, I got to refer you to employee assistance program. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to be more than that. You can't get somebody to open up about what's going on in their life and then suddenly go management on them and go, okay, well, I got to refer you to EAP. That it only happens one time because every other cop on your squad's going to go, hey, if the sergeant asks you what's going on in your life, tell him you're fine.
Don't say, yeah.
Because you're going to they're going to send you to EAP. And that's a stigma.
Yeah.
So it's a complicated issue.
Yeah.
And there aren't simplistic answers, but there are definitely avenues that we can take to make our officers better people and better cops that will, and that betterment will extend to their family life. It'll extend to their police life, and it will last after they retire.
Yeah.
And so we have to have a holistic approach. And I don't mean it's not simplistic. I'm telling you, I was never diagnosed PTSD, but I did have panic attacks. I had, and it was job related. And I wasn't ordered to EAP. I kept my mouth shut.
Sure.
I never told a soul in the department that I had panic attacks. But then I went and got counseling from a psychologist, and I worked through what was triggering those panic attacks. But I kept my mouth shut departmentally because of the stigma that's attached with going, hey, I'm struggling. We need to get rid of that mindset.
Yeah, I agree. Let's pivot a little bit. Let's talk about recruitment and retention a little bit. Hot topics. A lot of attrition going on there. You know, Pat, I mean, in law enforcement people, I don't think I know a couple people that are staying in. Thank God they are. A lot of people I talk to, they're looking for an exit ramp. I don't know about the people you're talking to. So if I'm somebody who wants to get into law enforcement, and I come to you and I say, hey, Pat, you've had a good career in law enforcement. What would you tell me? You know, somebody who wants to get into law enforcement, what advice would you give me or anybody?
First, I'm going to ask you a question. And we were all asked this, but we were also all trained to give the Pat responses.
To help and serve and protect.
Why do you want to be a police officer? I want to protect and serve. Okay, that's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
That you're telling me what I want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in the recruiting process, particularly in the oral review boards and in the testing process, it needs to be more scenario based to get at the root of how people are thinking. I want to know how you think. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the flaws that we've had in recruiting is we're still asking the same questions in oral review boards that we asked 25 and 30 years ago.
Right.
And, yeah. And what we need to do is find out how you think. So, you know, if you were sitting across the table from me, I'd go, so Patrick, I want to give you a scenario. You're a young officer and you're on a call with your field training officer, or make you off probation, and you're on a call with another officer, and it's a robbery at the 7-Eleven. And so you get there and the clerk tells you, well, I got video back in the office of the robbery. You go back there with him and you're going to get the tape from the video. And you happen to look up at the monitor and you see your partner dipping a roll of quarters out of the cash register and put them in his pocket. What are you going to do?
Yeah, those ethical questions.
That should be in recruitment.
Yeah.
That should be in the recruiting process, the hiring process. What are you going to do? And if the answer is, I don't know, hey, it's been good having this talk with you. See you.
Yeah.
There is no gray area in that. And if they don't know what they're going to do, then it leads you to believe their maturity level or their moral compass is askew. So I think from went to young people, that go, hey, I want to be a cop. I'll ask them why, so they can get it off their chest that why I want to protect and serve. I want to get back to the community, which are great foundation, if you will, but that doesn't tell me how you think. That doesn't tell me how you're going to respond to what you're going to have to do as a cop. If I say to you, hey, here's a scenario. You get dispatched on a family trouble and you get there and you just, the mom is just whacked out of her mind on drugs and little kids in the run around screaming hysterically and take you to the kitchen and point to the microwave. And you open the microwave and you discover that mom put her infant child in there and hit start. Yeah. What are you going to do? How's that going to make you feel? What, you know, tell me, yeah, and go through that. And then if you get that sense of that the person that wants to be a cop does have that protect and defend mentality and mindset, but they also have the compassion and empathy of a servant. And you phrase questions. You have a 12-year-old kid that's run away from home and you get called to the house because he's returned home and the parents ask you to sit down and talk to him. Because they're at their wit's end. What are you going to do? And that, actually, that story's in my book. That mm-hmm. happened to me. I was a 38-year-old white guy, skinny white cop. You know, I only weighed like 150 pounds back then. And and it was a couple, African-American couple. They both worked. They weren't on welfare. They put paying tuition to have their kid in private school, but he's running with the wrong crowd in the neighborhood. And they reported him missing. And I come at 2 o'clock in the morning because I catch the call that he came home. So I got to do the return missing. And they say to me, will you talk to him? We don't know what else to do. So you give that as a scenario sure. to a recruit. What are you going to do? And then if they go, well, I'd refer them to X, Y, or Z, you know, family counseling or whatever. Wrong answer. That's the easy yeah. way out. A leader, a person of influence and impact, which you claim you want to be a leader in law enforcement, is going to go, absolutely, I'll talk to your son. And that's what I said. But I said, I need to talk to him, just me and him, not you.
Yeah.
And I sat down and I talked to him for 10 minutes. He never even looked at me. 18 years later, I'm standing in line at Kroger's, King Supers, whatever you want to call it. We called it Kroger's in Ohio. And this there's two people, there's a little old lady next to me, behind me, and then somebody behind her. And that somebody behind her is about a 6'2" black male in his early 30s. And he goes, hey, Welsh, is that you? I'm off duty. And I look at him, my first thought is, well, he's not a cop. what did I arrest him for? You know, I go from yellow, you know, to quiet, you know, kind of almost red, you know, and who calls you by your last name? And I said, yes, it is, Matt. I'm sorry. I asked who's asking. He goes, you probably don't remember me. I go, no, sir, I don't. He goes, when I was 12 years old, I ran away from home. And you were the officer that came to the house, sat down, talked to me. Now, this is 18 years later.
Wow.
He goes, I want to tell you, I graduated from college. I'm married. I have two daughters. I want to say thank you. Wow. That's the kind of cop experience we want the community to have.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have that if you don't look for that in your recruiting process. And then it has to be in recruiting. It has to be in the academy. It has to be reinforced, you know, throughout the officers' careers. This is the culture we want. This is what we expect and accept in the way of thinking, talking, and acting with dealing with the community. And when you have to take care of business, take care of business. But you also have to be a problem solver with empathy and compassion. And it's doable. I know it's doable.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. It's getting the right people on the bus.
Right. And but we have to start in that recruiting process.
Yeah.
And we need to be telling people, this is what we in our recruiting. We can't just be looking to fill bodies and seats to take an exam. You know, I don't want 1,200 people that are just looking for a job and a paycheck. Or I think it'd be cool to be a cop. Or I've always wanted to be a cop. I don't know why, but it looks like fun.
Yeah.
Now, you know what? I want 100 people who I'm going to have a hard time going, dang, I can only hire 50 of you.
Yeah.
And I want all 100.
Yeah.
And so we need to get that message out. This don't sign up just because you're unemployed and the unemployment office says you have to go look for a job. Well, the cops are giving a test. I'll sign up to take the test.
Yeah.
You know, in Dayton, we would have 1,200 sign up and maybe 600 show up. Well, we just wasted a whole lot of time processing applications to take the test of 600 people. The corporate world doesn't do that. So why are we doing it? You know, they're laser focused. Mm-hmm. Their HR departments are laser focused in getting the best qualified and then streamlining the process to get it down to whatever your finalists are.
Mm-hmm.
And they have processes in place and they have benchmarks and things they're looking for. But we don't do that and it's not just in law enforcement. I mean, it's kind of public hiring.
Well, but I think it goes back to what you said, Pat.
Across that way.
I mean, it's changing the culture, and that's part of it. We have to change the culture. Now, what's your take on retention? Again, I talk to a lot of cops that, you know, unfortunately they want to leave for a variety of reasons. But thank God, you know, people are still coming on board, people who are passionate about serving and protecting and what we talked about. But how do we, maybe you get somebody who's just kind of burned out. Maybe you get somebody who's, you know, loves being a cop, but they're just burned out. You know, they're thinking about how do we retain that talent? I mean, some people need to leave, you know, that the rods, like you were talking about, retired on duty. Okay. They just don't want to be there anymore. But I'm talking about how do we retain the talent that wants to be there? Maybe they're burned out. You know what I mean? I mean, because I think a lot of people are like that now, a lot of cops. And so how do we retain that talent?
I think, first of all, you have to be relationship building driven throughout a cop's career. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, there's a hierarchy, the bar, stars and stripes and all that kind of stuff in law enforcement that, you know, when you get promoted to supervision, you're now not one of them, you know, in patrol, you're not a line officer. And there's this, and we lose a lot of opportunity to build relationships. And it shouldn't be that way.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, your folks have to genuinely trust and believe in their leadership. And I do mean organizational leadership.
Yeah.
So that if the sergeant comes to you and says, hey, and has that, wants to have that open and frank conversation, you're going to get open and frank conversation as opposed to, you know, one word answers, like your kids. You know, if you have a little, if you have a child that comes home from school every day and they're just a little chatty catty, you know, Tommy, how was your day at school today? Man, they tell you what every kid in the classroom did. And and then one day they come home and go, you go, Tommy, how was your day at school today? Fine. And that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, did something happen? No. And it's like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
Well, with the adult world, it shouldn't be by pulling teeth, but we have to have that relationship that your troop will trust you to go, hey, here's what's going on. I'm burned out, not because of police work. I'm burned out because, you know, we had, you know, a newborn 8 months ago and she's still not sleeping through the night. And I'm on midnights. I'm burned out because I'm just exhausted. And the problem to solve may be something as simple as, well, if I can get you on days and work around your schedule, you know, do something, then that may solve the problem. But you have to first know what the problem is.
Sure.
And a lot of cops will tell you, hey, I'm just burned out. Well, that's great. Now tell what me specifically.
Yeah.
Is it job related? Is it family related? You know, what's going on? Maybe their parent has terminal cancer and they're just overwhelmed with all sorts of stuff going on in their personal life. So that how do you, and they, it gets to the point where they're going to start getting racking up discipline stuff. Like they fall, catching their sleep in their cruiser. When in reality, you could have done something to solve the problem at the front end. But if you don't have the relationship and the trust already built up, they're not going to tell you. So I think that's one of the retention things. But you're right. There are absolutely cops that have no business being cops anymore. And how you deal with that is document, and then go through the termination process if they're not going to leave voluntarily. Bad apples, get rid of them.
And I used to tell people, look, if you're not happy, if you don't want to be here, I'll help you find the door. And that's the reality of it. Such great insight, brother. Really quick, tell us about the book really quick. Warrior, Servant Leader, Life Behind the Badge. Tell us about the book and where can they find it and where can they find you?
The book's on Amazon, so that's an easy answer. I wrote about 20, 25 articles for Law Enforcement Today over a period of years. And the articles could only be 1,200 words. And I was writing articles one of the ones I got the most response, quickest response was, I effing hate people. That was the title of it. And, you know, but if you read, you got to the third sentence of the first paragraph is, if that's what you really believe, get out of law enforcement. Yeah. So I got a lot of hate mail on that one.
Yeah.
I was limited to 1,200 words. And after a couple of years, and then I retired in 2012, and I kept writing articles. And then it finally hit me, I have the foundation for a book. I can take these 1,200 word articles and expand. There's a lot more I wanted to share. So I sat down and created a book from that wealth of articles. And some of it's funny. There's a chapter on future felons of America, what not to name your child. You know, if you name your kid, true story, the Al Capone, Al Pacino, he's not going to grow up to be a rocket scientist. And I helped send him away for 2 counts of murder. So there's some funny stuff in there. Yeah. There's a chapter on a leadership lesson I learned from accidental discharge. I shot a chair in my office. And there was a genuine leadership lesson I learned in that. So that's, but then it also includes challenges.
Yeah.
The book does, you know. I kind of question you. One of the things I want people to do is, you know, keep a journal, write stuff down, and be reflective. Intro reflection.
Mm-hmm.
If you're having a bad day, and you will turn out to be kind of a real ass to your coworkers, go apologize.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of stuff.
It goes a long way.
So it was kind of a fun book to write. It was kind of cathartic. I got a lot out of my system.
Yeah.
And helped me do some self-reflection myself as I was writing.
Yeah. It's therapy.
So, yeah, it is. So it's, it was therapy. It's on Amazon. it's on Amazon, on LinkedIn. I'm not on Facebook anymore. I'm not on Twitter anymore. I'm not on Instagram anymore for a lot of the obvious reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
But I am on LinkedIn. So Pat Welsh, JD, if you just do that, Pat Welsh, JD, Jersey Doctor. You can find me on LinkedIn or my website's pjwelshllc.com.
Patrick, and, thank you.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, I'm always, I always post.
Yeah, I know. I saw. I see you all the time posting.
Yeah, well, but you also see, you know, need help? Just ask.
Yeah.
So I tell people, just ask me, call me, email me. I'm open. So.
Well, Pat Welsh, thank you so much, sir, for your time, your service, dedication to law enforcement. Even now, you're still giving back to the brave men and women who protect us every day. Everything we talked about will be in the show notes, sir. Anything I can do for you, please, you know how to get a hold of me. Reach out to me. Much success to you in the future, sir. And I hope to talk to you down the road.
All right. Great. Thanks, Patrick.
All right, brother. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.